must be to blame somehow. The way I raised Dick. Maybe I did do something wrong. Only I don't know what it could have been. I get headaches trying to remember. We're plain people. Just country people, getting along the same as everybody else. We had some good times at our house. I taught Dick the foxtrot. Dancing. I was always crazy about it. It was my whole life when I was a girl. And there was a boy. Gosh, he could dance like Christmas. We won a silver cup waltzing together. For a long time, we planned to run away and go on the stage. Vaudeville. It was just a dream. Children dreaming. He left town, and one day I married Walter, and Walter Hickok couldn't do step one. He said if I wanted a hoofer, I should have married a horse. Nobody ever danced with me again until I learned Dick, and he didn't take to it exactly, but he was sweet. Dick was the best-natured little kid. Mrs. Hickok removed the spectacles she was wearing, polished the smeared lenses, and resettled them on her pudgy, agreeable face. There's lots more to Dick than what you hear back there in the courtroom. The lawyers jabbering how terrible he is. No good at all. I can't make any excuses for what he did. His part in it. I'm not forgetting that family. I pray for them every night. But I pray for Dick, too. And this boy Perry. It was wrong of me to hate him. I've got nothing but pity for him now. And you know, I believe Mrs. Clutter would feel pity, too, being the kind of woman they say she was. Court had adjourned. The noises of the departing audience clattered in the corridor beyond the lavatory door. Mrs. Hickok said she must go and meet her husband. He's dying. I don't think he minds anymore. Many observers of the trial scene were baffled by the visitor from Boston, Donald Cullivan. They could not quite understand why this staid young Catholic, a successful engineer who had taken his degree at Harvard, a husband and the father of three children, should choose to befriend an uneducated, homicidal half-breed whom he knew but slightly and had not seen for 9 years. Cullivan himself said, "My wife doesn't understand it either. Coming out here was something I couldn't afford to do. It meant using a week of my vacation, and money we really need for other things. On the other hand, it was something I couldn't afford not to do. Perry's lawyer wrote me asking if I would be a character witness. The moment I read the letter, I knew I had to do it. Because I'd offered this man my friendship. And because, well, I believe in the life everlasting. All souls can be saved for God. The salvation of a soul, namely Perry Smith's, was an enterprise the deeply Catholic undersheriff and his wife were eager to assist. Although Mrs. Meyer had been rebuffed by Perry when she had suggested a consultation with Father Goubeau, a local priest. Perry said, "Priests and nuns have had their chance with me. I'm still wearing the scars to prove it." And so, during the weekend recess, the Myers invited Cullivan to eat Sunday dinner with the prisoner in his cell. The opportunity to entertain his friend, play host as it were, delighted Perry, and the planning of the menu, wild goose, stuffed and roasted, with gravy and creamed potatoes and string beans, aspic salad, hot biscuits, cold milk, freshly baked cherry tarts, cheese and coffee, seemed to concern him more than the outcome of the trial, which, to be sure, he did not consider a suspenseful matter. "Those prairie billies, they'll vote to hang fast as pigs eat slop. Look at their eyes. I'll be damned if I'm the only killer in the courtroom." All Sunday morning he prepared to receive his guest. The day was warm, a little windy, and leaf shadows, supple emanations from the tree boughs that brushed the cell's barred window, tantalized Perry's tamed squirrel. Big Red chased the swaying patterns while his master swept and dusted, scrubbed the floor and scoured the toilet and cleared the desk of literary accumulations. The desk was to be the dining table, and once Perry had finished setting it, it looked most inviting, for Mrs. Meyer had donated a linen tablecloth, starched napkins, and her best china and silver. Cullivan was impressed. He whistled when the feast, arriving on trays, was placed upon the table. And before sitting down, he asked the host if he might offer a blessing. The host, head unbowed, cracked his knuckles as Cullivan, with bowed head and palms together, intoned, "Bless us, O Lord, in these thy gifts which we are about to receive from thy bounty through the mercy of Christ our Lord. Amen." Perry murmuringly remarked that in his opinion any credit due belonged to Mrs. Meyer. She did all the work. "Well," he said, heaping his guest's plate, "it's good to see you, Don. You look just the same. Haven't changed a bit." Cullivan, in appearance a cautious bank clerk with depleted hair and a face rather difficult to recall, agreed that outwardly he hadn't changed much. But his interior self, the invisible man, was another matter. "I was coasting along. Not knowing God is the only reality. Once you realize that, then everything falls into place. Life has meaning. And so does death. Boy, do you always eat like this?" Perry laughed. "She's really a terrific cook, Mrs. Meyer. You ought to taste your Spanish rice. I've gained 15 pounds since I got here. Of course, I was on the thin side. I'd lost a lot of weight while Dick and me were out on the road riding all to hell and gone. Hardly ever eating a square meal. Hungry as hell most of the time. Mostly, we lived like animals. Dick was always stealing canned stuff out of grocery stores. Baked beans and canned spaghetti. We'd open it up in the car and gobble it cold. Animals. Dick loves to steal. It's an emotional thing with him. A sickness. I'm a thief, too, but only if I don't have the money to pay. Dick, if he was carrying $100 in his pocket, he'd steal a stick of chewing gum." Later, over cigarettes and coffee, Perry returned to the subject of thievery. "My friend Willie J. used to talk about it. He used to say that all crimes were only varieties of theft. Murder included. When you kill a man, you steal his life. I guess that makes me a pretty big thief. See, Don, I did kill them. Down there in court, old Dewey made it sound like I was prevaricating on account of Dick's mother. Well, I wasn't. Dick helped me. He held the flashlight and picked up the shells. And it was his idea, too. But Dick didn't shoot them. He never could have. Though he's damn quick when it comes to running down an old dog. I wonder why I did it." He scowled, as though the problem was new to him, a newly unearthed stone of surprising, unclassified color. "I don't know why," he said, as if holding it to the light and angling it now here, now there. "I was sore at Dick, the tough brass boy. But it wasn't Dick, or the fear of being identified. I was willing to take that gamble. And it wasn't because of anything the Clutters did. They never hurt me. Like other people. Like people have all my life. Maybe it's just that the Clutters were the ones who had to pay for it." Cullivan probed, trying to gauge the depth of what he assumed would be Perry's contrition. Surely he must be experiencing a remorse sufficiently profound to summon a desire for God's mercy and forgiveness. Perry said, "Am I sorry? If that's what you mean, I'm not. I don't feel anything about it. I wish I did. But nothing about it bothers me a bit. Half an hour after it happened, Dick was making jokes, and I was laughing at them. Maybe we're not human. I'm human enough to feel sorry for myself. Sorry I can't walk out of here when you walk out. But that's all." Cullivan could scarcely credit so detached an attitude. Perry was confused, mistaken, It was not possible for any man to be that devoid of conscience or compassion. Perry said, "Why? Soldiers don't lose much sleep. They murder and get medals for doing it. The good people of Kansas want to murder me, and some hangman will be glad to get the work. It's easy to kill. A lot easier than passing a bad check. Just remember, I only knew the Clutters maybe an hour. If I'd really known them, I guess I'd feel different. I don't think I could live with myself. But the way it was like picking off targets in a shooting gallery." Cullivan was silent, and his silence upset Perry, who seemed to interpret it as implying disapproval. "Hell, Don, don't make me act the hypocrite with you. Throw a load of bull, how sorry I am, how all I want to do now is crawl on my knees and pray. That stuff don't ring with me. I can't accept overnight what I've always denied. The truth is, you've done more for me than any what you call God ever has, or ever will, by writing to me, by signing yourself friend, when I had no friends, except Joe James." Joe James, he explained to Cullivan, was a young Indian logger with whom he had once lived in a forest near Bellingham, Washington. That's a long way from Garden City. A good 2,000 miles. I sent word to Joe about the trouble I'm in. Joe's a poor guy. He's got 7 kids to feed. But he promised to come here if he had to walk. He hasn't shown up yet. And maybe he won't. Only I think he will. Joe always liked me. Do you, Don? Yes. I like you. Cullivan's softly emphatic answer pleased and rather flustered Perry. He smiled and said, "Then you must be some kind of nut." Suddenly rising, he crossed the cell and picked up a broom. "I don't know why I should die among strangers. Let a bunch of prairie billies stand around and watch me strangle. Shit. I ought to kill myself first." He lifted the broom and pressed the bristles against the light bulb that burned in the ceiling. "Just unscrew the bulb and smash it and cut my wrists. That's what I ought to do. While you're still here, somebody who cares about me a little bit." The trial resumed on Monday morning at 10 o'clock. 90 minutes later, the court adjourned, the case for the defense having been completed in that brief time. The defendants declined to testify in their own behalf, and therefore the question of whether Hickok or Smith had been the actual executioner of the Clutter family did not arise. Of the 5 witnesses who did appear, the first was the hollow-eyed Mr. Hickok. Though he spoke with a dignified and mournful clarity, he had but one contribution to make that was relevant to a claim of temporary insanity. His son, he said, had suffered head injuries in a car accident in July 1950. Prior to the accident, Dick had been a happy-go-lucky boy, had done well in school, been popular with his classmates, and considerate of his parents. No trouble to anybody. Harrison Smith, gently guiding the witness, said, "I will ask you if, after July 1950, you observed any change in the personality and habits and actions of your son Richard." "He just didn't act like the same boy." "What were the changes you observed?" Mr. Hickok, between pensive hesitations, listed several. "Dick was sulky and restless. He ran around with older men, drank and gambled. He just wasn't the same boy." The last assertion was promptly challenged by Logan Green, who undertook the cross-examination. "Mr. Hickok, you say you never had any trouble with your son until after 1950?
"I think he got arrested in 1949.
A citric smile bent Green's tiny lips.
"Remember what he was arrested for?" "He was accused of breaking into a drugstore."
"Accused?
Didn't he admit that he broke into the store?" That's right. He did. And that was in 1949. Yet now you tell us your son had a change in his attitude and conduct after 1950? I would say so, yes. You mean that after 1950 he became a good boy? Hard coughs agitated the old man. He spat into a handkerchief. No, he said, studying the discharge. I wouldn't say that. Then what was the change that took place? Well, that would be pretty hard to explain. He just didn't act like the same boy. You mean he lost his criminal tendencies? The lawyer's sally-induced guffaws, a courtroom flare-up that Judge Tate's dour gaze soon extinguished. Mr. Hickok, presently set free, was replaced on the stand by Dr. W. Mitchell Jones. Dr. Jones identified himself to the court as a physician specializing in the field of psychiatry, and in support of his qualifications, added that he had attended perhaps 1,500 patients since 1956, the year he had entered a psychiatric residency at Topeka State Hospital in Topeka, Kansas. For the past 2 years, he had served on the staff of Larned State Hospital, where he was in charge of the Dillon Building, a section reserved for the criminally insane. Harrison Smith asked the witness, "Approximately how many murderers have you dealt with?"
"About 25.
"Doctor, I would like to ask you if you know my client, Richard Eugene Hickok?"
"I do."
"Have you had occasion to examine him professionally?"
"Yes, sir."
"I made a psychiatric evaluation of Mr. Hickok." "Based upon your examination, do you have an opinion as to whether or not Richard Eugene Hickok knew right from wrong at the time of the commission of the crime?" The witness, a stout man of 28 with a moon-shaped but intelligent, subtly delicate face, took a deep breath as though to equip himself for a prolonged reply, which the judge then cautioned him he must not make. "You may answer the question yes or no, doctor. Limit your answer to yes or no."
"Yes."
"And what is your opinion?"
"I think that within the usual definitions, Mr. Hickok did know right from wrong."
Confined as he was by the McNaughton rule, the usual definitions, a formula quite colorblind to any gradations between black and white, Dr. Jones was impotent to answer otherwise. But, of course, the response was a letdown for Hickok's attorney, who hopelessly asked, "Can you qualify that answer?" It was hopeless because, though Dr. Jones agreed to elaborate, the prosecution was entitled to object, and did, citing the fact that Kansas law allowed nothing more than a yes or no reply to the pertinent question. The objection was upheld, and the witness dismissed. However, had Dr. Jones been allowed to speak further, here is what he would have testified. "Richard Hickok is above average in intelligence, grasps new ideas easily, and has a wide fund of information. He is alert to what is happening around him, and he shows no sign of mental confusion or disorientation. His thinking is well organized and logical, and he seems to be in good contact with reality. Although I did not find the usual signs of organic brain damage, memory loss, concrete concept formation, intellectual deterioration, this cannot be completely ruled out. He had a serious head injury with concussion and several hours of unconsciousness in 1950. This was verified by me by checking hospital records. He says he has had blackout spells, periods of amnesia, and headaches ever since that time, and a major portion of his antisocial behavior has occurred since that time. He has never had the medical tests which would definitely prove or disprove the existence of residual brain damage. Definitive medical tests are indicated before a complete evaluation can be said to exist. Hickok does show signs of emotional abnormality. That he knew what he was doing and still went ahead with it is possibly the most clear-cut demonstration of this fact. He is a person who is impulsive in action, likely to do things without thought of consequences or future discomfort to himself or to others. He does not seem to be capable of learning from experience, and he shows an unusual pattern of intermittent periods of productive activity followed by patently irresponsible actions. He cannot tolerate feelings of frustration as a more normal person can, and he is poorly able to rid himself of those feelings except through antisocial activity. His self-esteem is very low, and he secretly feels inferior to others and sexually inadequate. These feelings seem to be overcompensated for by dreams of being rich and powerful, a tendency to brag about his exploits, spending sprees when he has money, and dissatisfaction with only the normal slow advancement he could expect from his job. He is uncomfortable in his relationships to other people and has a pathological inability to form and hold enduring personal attachments. Although he professes usual moral standards, he seems obviously uninfluenced by them in his actions. In summary, he shows fairly typical characteristics of what would psychiatrically be called a severe character disorder. It is important that steps be taken to rule out the possibility of organic brain damage, since, if present, it might have substantially influenced his behavior during the past several years and at the time of the crime. Aside from a formal plea to the jury, which would not take place until the morrow, the psychiatrist's testimony terminated Hickok's planned defense. Next, it was the turn of Arthur Fleming, Smith's elderly counselor. He presented four witnesses: the Reverend James E. Post, the Protestant chaplain at Kansas State Penitentiary; Perry's Indian friend, Joe James, who, after all, had arrived by bus that morning, having traveled a day and two nights from his wilderness home in the far northwest; Donald Cullivan; and once again, Dr. Jones. Except for the latter, these men were offered as character witnesses, persons expected to attribute to the accused a few human virtues. They did not fare very well, though each of them negotiated some skimpily favorable remark before the protesting prosecution, which contended that personal comments of this nature were incompetent, irrelevant, immaterial, hushed and banished them. For example, Joe James, dark-haired, even darker-skinned than Perry, a lithe figure who, with his faded huntsman's shirt and moccasined feet, looked as though he had that instant mysteriously emerged from woodland shadows, told the court that the defendant had lived with him off and on for over 2 years. Perry was a likable kid, well-liked around the neighborhood. He never done one thing out of the way to my knowledge. The state stopped him there, and stopped Cullivan, too, when he said, "During the time I knew him in the army, Perry was a very likable fellow." The Reverend Post survived somewhat longer, for he made no direct attempt to compliment the prisoner, but described sympathetically an encounter with him at Lansing. "I first met Perry Smith when he came to my office in the prison chapel with a picture he had painted, a head-and-shoulders portrait of Jesus Christ done in pastel crayon. He wanted to give it to me for use in the chapel. It's been hanging on the walls of my office ever since." Fleming said, "Do you have a photograph of that painting?" The minister had an envelope full, but when he produced them, ostensibly for distribution among the jurors, an exasperated Logan Green leaped to his feet. "If Your Honor please, this is going too far." His Honor saw that it went no further. Dr. Jones was now recalled, and following the preliminaries that had accompanied his original appearance, Fleming put to him the crucial query. "From your conversations and examination of Perry Edward Smith, do you have an opinion as to whether he knew right from wrong at the time of the offense involved in this action?" And once more the court admonished the witness, "Answer yes or no. Do you have an opinion?" "No." Amid surprised mutters, Fleming, surprised himself, said, "You may state to the jury why you have no opinion." Green objected. "The man has no opinion, and that's it." Which it was, legally speaking. But had Dr. Jones been permitted to discourse on the cause of his indecision, he would have testified, Perry Smith shows definite signs of severe mental illness. His childhood, related to me and verified by portions of the prison records, was marked by brutality and lack of concern on the part of both parents. He seems to have grown up without direction, without love, and without ever having absorbed any fixed sense of moral values. He is oriented, hyper-alert to things going on about him, and shows no sign of confusion. He is above average in intelligence and has a good range of information considering his poor educational background. Two features in his personality makeup stand out as particularly pathological. The first is his paranoid orientation toward the world. He is suspicious and distrustful of others, tends to feel that others discriminate against him, and feels that others are unfair to him and do not understand him. He is overly sensitive to criticisms that others make of him, and cannot tolerate being made fun of. He is quick to sense slight or insult in things others say, and frequently may misinterpret well-meant communications. He feels he has great need of friendship and understanding, but he is reluctant to confide in others, and when he does, expects to be misunderstood or even betrayed. In evaluating the intentions and feelings of others, his ability to separate the real situation from his own mental projections is very poor. He not infrequently groups all people together as being hypocritical, hostile, and deserving of whatever he is able to do to them. Akin to this first trait is the second, an ever-present, poorly controlled rage, easily triggered by any feeling of being tricked, slighted, or labeled inferior by others. For the most part, his rages in the past have been directed at authority figures. Father, brother, army sergeant, state parole officer, and have led to violent, assaultive behavior on several occasions. Both he and his acquaintances have been aware of these rages, which he says mount up in him, and of the poor control he has over them. When turned toward himself, his anger has precipitated ideas of suicide. The inappropriate force of his anger and lack of ability to control or channel it reflect a primary weakness of personality structure. In addition to these traits, the subject shows mild early signs of a disorder of his thought processes. He has poor ability to organize his thinking. He seems unable to scan or summarize his thought, becoming involved and sometimes lost in detail, and some of his thinking reflects a magical quality, a disregard of reality. He has had few close emotional relationships with other people, and these have not been able to stand small crises. He has little feeling for others outside a very small circle of friends, and attaches little real value to human life. This emotional detachment and blandness in certain areas is other evidence of his mental abnormality. More extensive evaluation would be necessary to make an exact psychiatric diagnosis, but his present personality structure is very nearly that of a paranoid schizophrenic reaction. It is significant that a widely respected veteran in the field of forensic psychiatry, Dr. Joseph Satin of the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas, consulted with Dr. Jones and endorsed his evaluations of Hickok and Smith. Dr. Satin, who afterward gave the case close attention, suggests that though the crime would not have occurred except for a certain frictional interplay between the perpetrators, it was essentially the act of Perry Smith, who he feels represents a type of murderer described by him in an article. Murder without apparent motive, a study in personality disorganization. The article, printed in the American Journal of Psychiatry, July 1960, and written in collaboration with three colleagues, Carl Menninger, Erwin Rosen, and Martin Maiman, states its aim at the outset. In attempting to assess the criminal responsibility of murderers, the law tries to divide them, as it does all offenders, into two groups, the sane and the insane. The sane murderer is thought of as acting upon rational motives that can be understood, though condemned, and the insane one as being driven by irrational, senseless motives.
when rational motives are conspicuous, for example, when a man kills for personal gain, or when the irrational motives are accompanied by delusions or hallucinations, for example, a paranoid patient who kills his fantasied persecutor, the situation presents little problem to the psychiatrist. But murderers who seem rational, coherent, and controlled, and yet whose homicidal acts have a bizarre, apparently senseless quality, pose a difficult problem, if courtroom disagreements and contradictory reports about the same offender are an index. It is our thesis that the psychopathology of such murderers forms at least one specific syndrome which we shall describe. In general, these individuals are predisposed to severe lapses in ego control, which makes possible the open expression of primitive violence, born out of previous, and now unconscious, traumatic experiences. The authors, as part of an appeals process, had examined four men convicted of seemingly unmotivated murders. All had been examined prior to their trials and found to be without psychosis and sane. Three of the men were under death sentence, and the fourth was serving a long prison sentence. In each of these cases, further psychiatric investigation had been requested because someone, either the lawyer, a relative, or a friend, was dissatisfied with the psychiatric explanations previously given, and in effect had asked, "How can a person as sane as this man seems to be commit an act as crazy as the one he was convicted of?" After describing the four criminals and their crimes, a Negro soldier who mutilated and dismembered a prostitute, a laborer who strangled a 14-year-old boy when the boy rejected his sexual advances, an army corporal who bludgeoned to death another young boy because he imagined the victim was making fun of him, and a hospital employee who drowned a girl of 9 by holding her head underwater, the authors surveyed the areas of similarity. The men themselves, they wrote, were puzzled as to why they killed their victims, who were relatively unknown to them, and in each instance the murderer appears to have lapsed into a dreamlike dissociative trance from which he awakened to suddenly discover himself assaulting his victim. The most uniform, and perhaps the most significant, historical finding was a long-standing, sometimes lifelong, history of erratic control over aggressive impulses. For example, three of the men, throughout their lives, had been frequently involved in fights which were not ordinary altercations, and which would have become homicidal assaults if not stopped by others. Here, in excerpt, are a number of other observations contained in the study. Despite the violence in their lives, all of the men had ego images of themselves as physically inferior, weak, and inadequate. The histories revealed in each a severe degree of sexual inhibition. To all of them, adult women were threatening creatures, and in two cases there was overt sexual perversion. All of them, too, had been concerned throughout their early years about being considered sissies, physically undersized or sickly. In all four cases, there was historical evidence of altered states of consciousness, frequently in connection with the outbursts of violence. Two of the men reported severe dissociative trance-like states during which violent and bizarre behavior was seen, while the other two reported less severe and perhaps less well-organized amnesiac episodes. During moments of actual violence, they often felt separated or isolated from themselves, as if they were watching someone else. Also seen in the historical background of all the cases was the occurrence of extreme parental violence during childhood. One man said he was whipped every time I turned around. Another of the men had many violent beatings in order to break him of his stammering and fits, as well as to correct him for his allegedly bad behavior. The history relating to extreme violence, whether fantasied, observed in reality, or actually experienced by the child, fits in with the psychoanalytic hypothesis that the child's exposure to overwhelming stimuli before he can master them is closely linked to early defects in ego formation and later severe disturbances in impulse control. In all of these cases, there was evidence of severe emotional deprivation in early life. This deprivation may have involved prolonged or recurrent absence of one or both parents,
a chaotic family life in which the parents were unknown, or an outright rejection of the child by one or both parents, with the child being raised by others. Evidence of disturbances in affect organization was seen. Most typically, the men displayed a tendency not to experience anger or rage in association with violent, aggressive action. None reported feelings of rage in connection with the murders, nor did they experience anger in any strong or pronounced way, although each of them was capable of enormous and brutal aggression. Their relationships with others were of a shallow, cold nature, lending a quality of loneliness and isolation to these men. People were scarcely real to them, in the sense of being warmly or positively, or even angrily, felt about. The three men under sentence of death had shallow emotions regarding their own fate and that of their victims. Guilt, depression, and remorse were strikingly absent. Such individuals can be considered to be murder-prone in the sense of either carrying a surcharge of aggressive energy or having an unstable ego defense system that periodically allows the naked and archaic expression of such energy. The murderous potential can become activated, especially if some disequilibrium is already present, when the victim-to-be is unconsciously perceived as a key figure in some past traumatic configuration. The behavior, or even the mere presence of this figure, adds a stress to the unstable balance of forces that results in a sudden, extreme discharge of violence, similar to the explosion that takes place when a percussion cap ignites a charge of dynamite. The hypothesis of unconscious motivation explains why the murderers perceived innocuous and relatively unknown victims as provocative and thereby suitable targets for aggression. But why murder? Most people, fortunately, do not respond with murderous outbursts, even under extreme provocation. The cases described, on the other hand, were predisposed to gross lapses in reality contact and extreme weakness in impulse control during periods of heightened tension and disorganization. At such times, a chance acquaintance or even a stranger was easily able to lose his real meaning and assume an identity in the unconscious traumatic configuration. The old conflict was reactivated and aggression swiftly mounted to murderous proportions. When such senseless murders occur, they are seen to be an end result of a period of increasing tension and disorganization in the murderer starting before the contact with the victim, who, by fitting into the unconscious conflicts of the murderer, unwittingly serves to set into motion his homicidal potential. Because of the many parallels between the background and personality of Perry Smith and the subjects of his study, Dr. Satin feels secure in assigning him to a position among their ranks. Moreover, the circumstances of the crime seem to him to fit exactly the concept of murder without apparent motive. Obviously, three of the murders Smith committed were logically motivated. Nancy, Kenyon, and their mother had to be killed because Mr. Clutter had been killed. But it is Dr. Satin's contention that only the first murder matters psychologically, and that when Smith attacked Mr. Clutter, he was under a mental eclipse, deep inside a schizophrenic darkness, for it was not entirely a flesh-and-blood man he suddenly discovered himself destroying, but a key figure in some past traumatic configuration. His father? The orphanage nuns who had derided and beaten him? The hated army sergeant? The parole officer who had ordered him to stay out of Kansas? One of them, or all of them? In his confession, Smith said, "I didn't want to harm the man. I thought he was a very nice gentleman. Soft-spoken. I thought so right up to the moment I cut his throat." While talking to Donald Cullivan, Smith said, "They, the Clutters, never hurt me. Like other people. Like people have all my life. Maybe it's just that the Clutters were the ones who had to pay for it." So it would appear that by independent paths, both the professional and the amateur analyst reached conclusions not dissimilar.
The aristocracy of Finney County had snubbed the trial. "It doesn't do," announced the wife of one rich rancher, "to seem curious about that sort of thing." Nevertheless, the trial's last session found a fair segment of the local establishment seated alongside the plainer citizenry. Their presence was a courteous gesture toward Judge Tate and Logan Green, esteemed members of their own order. Also, a large contingent of out-of-town lawyers, many of whom had journeyed great distances, filled several benches. Specifically, they were on hand to hear Green's final address to the jury. Green, a suavely tough little septuagenarian, has an imposing reputation among his peers, who admire his stagecraft, a repertoire of actorish gifts that includes a sense of timing acute as a nightclub comedian's. An expert criminal lawyer, his usual role is that of defender, but in this instance the state had retained him as a special assistant to Duane West, for it was felt that the young county attorney was too unseasoned to prosecute the case without experienced support. But like most star turns, Green was the last act on the program. Judge Tate's level-headed instructions to the jury preceded him, as did the county attorney's summation. "Can there be a single doubt in your minds regarding the guilt of these defendants?" "No." "Regardless of who pulled the trigger on Richard Eugene Hickok's shotgun, both men are equally guilty. There is only one way to assure that these men will never again roam the towns and cities of this land. We request the maximum penalty. Death. This request is not made in vengeance, but in all humbleness." Then the pleas of the defense attorneys had to be heard. Fleming's speech, described by one journalist as soft sell, amounted to a mild churchly sermon. "Man is not an animal. He has a body, and he has a soul that lives forever. I don't believe man has the right to destroy that house, a temple in which the soul dwells." Harrison Smith, though he too appealed to the jurors' presumed Christianity, took as his main theme the evils of capital punishment. "It is a relic of human barbarism. The law tells us that the taking of human life is wrong, then goes ahead and sets the example, which is almost as wicked as the crime it punished. The state has no right to inflict it. It isn't effective. It doesn't deter crime, but merely cheapens human life and gives rise to more murders. All we ask is mercy. Surely life imprisonment is small mercy to ask." Not everyone was attentive. One juror, as though poisoned by the numerous spring fever yawns waiting the air, sat with drugged eyes and jaws so utterly ajar, bees could have buzzed in and out. Green woke them up. "Gentlemen," he said, speaking without notes, "you have just heard two energetic pleas for mercy in behalf of the defendants. It seems to me fortunate that these admirable attorneys, Mr. Fleming and Mr. Smith, were not at the Clutter House that fateful night. Very fortunate for them that they were not present to plead mercy for the doomed family. Because had they been there, well, come next morning we would have had more than four corpses to count." As a boy in his native Kentucky, Green was called Pinky, a nickname he owed to his freckled coloring. Now, as he strutted before the jury, the stress of his assignment warmed his face and splotched it with patches of pink. "I have no intention of engaging in theological debate, but I anticipated that defense counsel would use the Holy Bible as an argument against the death penalty. You have heard the Bible quoted, but I can read too." He slapped open a copy of the Old Testament. "And here are a few things the good book has to say on the subject. In Exodus 20, verse 13, we have one of the Ten Commandments: Thou shalt not kill. This refers to unlawful killing." "Of course it does, because in the next chapter, verse 12,
the penalty for disobedience of that commandment reads, He that smiteth a man so that he die shall be surely put to death.